This is a message for the Nathan B. Stubblefield Foundation's Board of Directors. The USF Forest Preserve is home to hundreds of acres of threatened wetland and sandhill habitats, as well as endangered plant and animal species. The preserve also contains at least 9 Native American historical sites and cemeteries. USF is now reviewing proposals to develop this land for economic gain. For information on the petition to stop this irresponsible and irreversible development and how you can help, visit SaveUSFForestPreserve.com.
Welcome to WMNF on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Today we're going to speak with a reporter from Creative Loafing about the hurdles faced in court by people who were arrested during Black Lives Matter protests in Tampa last year. We're also going to take your calls. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, you can call us at 813-239-9663. You can also email your comments to dj@wmnf.org, or you can text us at 813-433-0885. If you text, please sign your name so that I know who you are and where you're calling from. Well, the cover story in this week's Creative Loafing Tampa is about a Black Lives Matter protester who was arrested by Tampa police on the 4th of July, 2020. You'll remember that that was during the heated summer of protests for racial justice and against police violence. Today, we're going to talk to the author of that article. We're joined in the studio this morning by Justin Garcia. He's a reporter for Creative Loafing Tampa. His cover story this week is called "Taking a Stand, Tampa Protester Marched for Black Lives and Now Faces Up to 5 Years in Prison." Welcome back to WMNF, Justin.
Thank you, Sean. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, if you can move your mic just a little bit closer to you, that would work great. So your current article is about a woman named Jamie Bullock. What was going on in Tampa on the 4th of July, 2020, right before she was arrested?
So on that day, protesters gathered to essentially protest police brutality throughout the summer, but also in relation to what we now know as the murder of George Floyd and so many other black lives who have been taken by police. And they went out to Dale Mabry Highway and Spruce, I believe, was the main intersection they entered. They carried a defund the police banner, and they held the intersection and then started marching down the road, holding their banner and chanting different BLM-related slogans.
And we'll talk later about video that occurred in this demonstration, but there's no indication that there was anything that wasn't peaceful that was going on. I mean, they were blocking a roadway, but it looked like a peaceful march from the video that I saw. What else was going on at the time, right before the police kind of closed in?
Yeah, they had cars kind of protecting them, riding behind them, because throughout the summer, protesters had dealt with drivers who had plowed through crowds of protesters, injuring some, and oftentimes those drivers were not pursued, even though I personally even witnessed the police seeing one of the drivers hitting a protester who was standing in the road peacefully and letting the person go. So they did that as protection, and then they just kind of slowly got the intersection and held it so that way they could make sure everybody was safe. And then after about 10 minutes of doing that, they started marching north on Dale Mabry towards Columbus.
And there was an intersection there, and the police, bicycle police, were kind of on a side street. And in the video that we'll talk about in just a bit, you can see the police kind of riding perpendicular to the direction of the parade and then kind of going in front of the lead protesters. Some of them are holding a banner. And then so these 4 or 5 or 6 or,
I don't know. Four, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Bicycle police closed in. And describe kind of what happened after that.
Yeah, so I think here it's important to mention that the original story from the police was not that the police had flown down this side road and ran into protesters. It was that the protesters had decided to clash with the police. But the video that TPD's own aerial footage shows that the police are going full speed on their bikes down this side road. The audio shows that they were marking where the protesters were, and the next major intersection was Columbus, and they said that. And then at that point, the 4 bicycle police go full speed down this side road, enter into the crowd, and start essentially clashing with protesters. They grab one of them, put him on the ground. They unloaded mace as the protesters were kind of, you know, shocked. And the protesters kind of moved back, but the police kind of kept holding their ground on the street. And at that point, TPD called in reinforcements saying that they were attacking, their officers were being attacked by the protesters.
And again, we'll hear some of the audio from that in just a bit. But I want to remind people that we're speaking with Justin Garcia. He's a reporter for Creative Loafing Tampa. His cover story this week is called Taking a Stand. Tampa protester marched for Black Lives and now faces up to 5 years in prison. And that protester that you profile is Jamie Bullock. So what was she doing when she was arrested that day, July 4th, 2020, in that intersection in Tampa?
Yeah, well, I think here we should mention that she was out there that day because she had been personally affected by the police in her life. Her brother had a police-related or police-involved death that's still kind of shrouded in mystery for her. She's a Black woman, so, you know, watching George Floyd die, watching Breonna Taylor die had a major effect on her and hurt her a lot emotionally. But still, she had just been protesting peacefully that summer, all summer long. She had, leading up to the 4th, been maced while standing on a public a patch of grass near the sidewalk, filming her fellow protesters being attacked by police in downtown, essentially, as they were marching. And in that video, it shows her trying to record what was going on, and then all of a sudden, a big cloud of mace coming in from the side and macing her. So even leading up to the 4th, she had already undergone, you know, a lot of trauma. She had to take multiple showers after being maced and still couldn't really sleep well. But still, she went out there on the 4th and marched peacefully with those protesters. And when the police entered the crowd, she essentially was trying to see what was happening to her friends, just like everybody else out there. And then eventually the police turned on her too.
And she was tackled by the police. Describe mm-hmm. physically what it looked like to someone, if someone was watching her being arrested, what did it look like?
Yeah. So we have the aerial footage, but we also have body cam video from police that day. And it shows a number of things. It shows people being body slammed to the ground. It just shows a lot of aggression. But with her, it's not very clear in the body cam video, but there are photos as well. There are a ton of photos from Creative Loafing photographers who were out there that day. And it shows her on the ground, her chest being pushed in the ground, her face sideways on the ground. It was really hot that day, so she's basically being pushed into the burning pavement. Her hair was grabbed, her braids were, we have a screenshot of the body cam footage of her back of her head being grabbed by her braids and being pushed down. So she couldn't breathe as that was happening to her. And then she was essentially grabbed by multiple police officers and taken into a squad car at that point.
And we're talking about Jamie Bullock, a woman who was arrested on July 4th, 2020 in Tampa by Tampa police. How did she react when she was arrested, and what was she doing in the police car? How was she reacting then?
From what she's told me, she cried a lot. She cried uncontrollably. She was estimating for around 10 minutes. And there was someone next to her who was consoling her, a friend of hers. But it was essentially like everything came out right there in the back of that car, you know. And so it was a very emotional moment for her. And obviously being arrested is traumatic for anyone. So she was just confused and in a state of despair, essentially.
We're speaking with Justin Garcia, a reporter for Creative Loafing Tampa. His cover story this week is called Taking a Stand. Tampa protester marched for Black Lives and now faces up to 5 years in prison. And you're listening to WMNF Tampa. It's 10:15 in the morning, and my name is Sean Canaan, and we're speaking about Jamie Bullock as the protester who we're speaking about. Tell us about the charges that she faced. She was given, she was charged with one felony and two misdemeanors. What are those charges?
Yeah, battery on law enforcement was the felony charge that she was charged with and that she's facing. The obstruction of a city roadway. And then resisting arrest without violence. Those last two are the misdemeanors.
And for that felony, that could be potentially a 5-year prison sentence.
Yes, yeah, that's the maximum, I believe, for that kind of charge.
So now I think that maybe someone who's not familiar with protests and arrests and things like that might think, well, that's very serious. battery on a police officer, if I walked up to a police officer and just started walloping them, that would be a serious offense, and I should be charged with a felony. But in the heat of a protest, protesters are often charged, and then later on, it's often dismissed. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, a lot of cases were dismissed last year by Andrew Warren, the state attorney, who currently is the state attorney's office is the one waging the charges against Jamie based upon what TPD said. So a lot of those charges throughout the summer were dropped because the state attorney looked at them and said, you know, there's not really enough substantial evidence here, and dropped, I don't know the exact number, but a lot of the charges of protesters last year. And that'll happen because, yeah, there is a lot of confusion in those hectic protest environments. And then when you start looking deeper into it, sometimes you find things, you know, like we found with while writing about Jamie's story about, you know, from the aerial footage, from the helicopter footage, a TPD officer says on the radio, try to get charges on some of them if you can. So all of this complicates things as you dig deeper into the story.
Well, since we've mentioned that video a few times, let's go to the audio right now. Now, the video is like an hour and something minutes long, maybe 20 minutes long, I don't remember, but it's a very long video. But here's just a few seconds. I pulled out about 39 seconds of this video that just kind of gives you an idea of what Justin's talking about when you're talking about the how the police are reacting to the protesters. And this, so again, I'm going to tell people this is the video was shot from a helicopter right above this intersection where the Tampa police rode their bicycles in and kind of started arresting people in this crowd of peaceful marchers. But the video is from a bunch of different sources. I guess whoever's on the call with the PD, they're coordinating their response here. And so this is these are a few of the voices on a very short part of this video.
Arresting, moving to my team, Arresting, moving to my team.
Air 3, 10-3, get our guys up there. They're attacking our officers. I need everybody 10-18 to our officers in the very front.
Bruce in Palmetto.
Spruce and Palmetto, 10-18.
Spruce and Palmetto, 10-18.
Arrest team, watch your guys' back. Watch your back.
Try and get charges on somebody if you can.
Try to get charges on somebody if you can is how this clip of that video, that very long video audio ends. Justin, what's your take on what we're hearing there? As I said before, we mentioned this was on the 4th of July, 2020, the day that the subject of your article, Jamie Bullock, was arrested. And we're looking at helicopter video that's posted on the CL website. It's from Tampa Police. A line of bike cops crossed the march. They stopped the march and started arresting people. And then at the very end, we hear somebody from the police saying, try to get charges on somebody if you can. What else should people know about what they're hearing?
Yeah, well, leading up to that, in the video, when you hear them say, get our guys up here, they're attacking our officers, you can see the crowd. It's online on YouTube, on Creative Loafing's YouTube. You can watch the whole video. You know, we're trying to make sure this is transparent and people can see everything. But you can see the crowd kind of reacting to the cops, but moving back, even though they have somebody on the ground and they're worried about their fellow protester. You can see them kind of moving backwards a little bit, kind of responding to the police. And there's no evidence in that video of somebody from the protest just going out and attacking officers. It's all the police officers biking down the side street into the crowd, you know, enacting the aggression upon them. At least that's what the video seems to say. And then so they call for backup based on that. And as the police are interacting with this crowd of protesters and they're kind of moving forward, then moving back, and then mainly moving back, though. You can see them moving back and back down Del Mabry. That's when you hear that voice jump in and say, try to get charges on some of them if you can. And from the body cam video, too, there's a video, very clear video, and we included this in a previous story called Who Exactly is Allowed to Protest in Tampa, about the BLM marches compared to the Cuban protests recently. And in that, we included a video where it shows body cam footage of a police officer that day approaching a protester who's saying into a megaphone, just, why are we being arrested? That's what he's saying. Why are we being arrested? And that officer, the body cam shows officer, just rush him, grab this person, and slam the person on their back to the ground like a body slam. So there's just multiple different angles of video that show what happened that day very clearly. And you can get deeper into it, you know, like you go further into the aerial video and you see that same person who got body slammed. You see somebody in the aerial video say, "That's an agitator. I would take him out right now if you can." And you can then see the officer body slam this person who's just asking, "Why are we being arrested?" essentially.
And when you say, you hear someone say, "That's an agitator," the only sound, the only audio we're hearing is from the police in this particular video.
Yeah, and we always reach out to TPD. We always want to get both sides of the story. We tried to find out what officer that was. They didn't answer. We asked about the video, and it was directed to their team to consider, and then we were told, and this is included in the story, I've written now probably four or five stories about this situation, but it was included in the helicopter story where TPD responded to us basically saying that our decision to use that quote of try to get charges on somebody if you can was misleading. And we asked, you know, how is that misleading? What portion of audio would help people understand what happened here better? So that's why in the story we included, you know, everything leading up to it. Most of the audio from the helicopter is not very active, or from the dispatch is not very active up until the actual engagement of the protesters.
We're speaking with Justin Garcia. He's a reporter for Creative Loafing Tampa. His cover story this week is called "Taking a Stand: Tampa Protester Marched for Black Lives and Now Faces Up to 5 Years in Prison." And that Tampa protester that we're speaking about is Jamie Bullock. And she was given this felony charge of battery on a law enforcement officer. It's a third degree felony. It could carry up to, as you say in the subtitle, 5 years in prison. She was also given two misdemeanors, resisting arrest and obstructing a city roadway. So, but the Hillsborough County attorney has offered her a plea to get rid of that felony, to drop the felony, if she would plead guilty to the other two charges. But her response is, "No, I'm not going to plead guilty." Why has she told you that?
Essentially, she feels like she was standing up for her constitutional rights that day. She was standing up for the safety and health and lives of her community, you know. Like I said, she had already been through a lot that summer. Like I said, there's video of her being maced. And that day she was doing what there's a long history and tradition of doing in America, which is practicing a form of civil disobedience, which was, you know, massively popularized by Martin Luther King Jr., but has been around for hundreds of years. You know, people taking to the streets, people leaving factories, people basically expressing their dismay and dissent with a system that is not treating them correctly. And I think we can all objectively confirm that that's true. You know, when Chauvin is convicted of murder, we know that it's true that he abused George Floyd that day and killed him, you know. So she was basically out there practicing her First Amendment rights. And on that day, she was arrested for doing that, and she feels that that was wrong. And I don't want to speak for her too much, but essentially that's what I gathered from Jamie.
And that's actually kind of, you can act, or let me start that over. There's one way to look at that's a very risky decision that she made. She is potentially facing 5 years in prison if she doesn't plead guilty to these two misdemeanors. So that's a risk she's taking, but she feels so strongly, it seems, from what you're writing about and talking to her about, that she was innocent, that she's going to fight it. And so she had a court hearing a couple of weeks ago, but the Hillsborough State Attorney is making it, to an outside observer at least, who might not be super familiar with how these things work, it's kind of confusing. In what ways is the state attorney making it kind of what would seem like more difficult for her defense?
Yeah, so after not accepting the plea, first of all, there was a counter plea made by Jamie's defense team. And then after that, there was a motion in limine filed, essentially, by the state attorney's office, which limits what Jamie's defense team can talk about in court. And I really kind of want to read all of it since I have it pulled up in front of me, because it is pretty intense. So this motion would essentially restrict Jamie's defense team from speaking of the constitutionality of protests, the right to free speech in public assemblies, the alleged peaceful nature of the protest, law enforcement conduct generally in response to various protests locally and elsewhere, alleged acts of law enforcement officers as to detention, arrest, or alleged violent treatment of other protest attendees, allegations that law enforcement brutalized or otherwise harmed defendants, law enforcement officers' conduct that is unrelated to their direct interactions with the defendants, and the defendant's lack of criminal history. So that's everything that the motion that was filed seeks to bar speech of in court.
So one way of putting that is that the state attorney, when they go to court, they would like her defense team to not be able to bring up any of those things, which I think, I would guess, a defense attorney would say, wait a second, every single one of these things is exactly relevant to this case. My client wouldn't have been arrested if it weren't for all these other things like the First Amendment and like the concern about the behaviors of police officers, et cetera. All those things you just mentioned kind of are part of what you would think of as a defense.
Yeah.
So that hasn't been decided yet. The judge has to rule on that, right? So both sides are going to present their evidence. Should these limitations be put in place or not? When will that be decided?
On September 13th, I believe at 12:30 p.m. is what we have now. And that's at the Hillsborough County Courthouse. And there are a group of people, of activists who are planning on being there, even at Jamie's last hearing, where it was decided to discuss the motion on the 13th, there were probably about 30 people in the courtroom in Jamie's support. So on the 13th, the activists are calling out more people to essentially be there that day. But that's the day that they will discuss the motion, and the judge will ultimately have the power in that situation to decide if the motion stands. And you're right, for a defense team, it seems like this would be completely muzzling, to their defense. So,
well, we have a caller on the line, so why don't we take a call and see what Mike in Sarasota has to say. Hi, Mike, what's your question?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to begin by saying that your basic premise that BLM was exercising their First Amendment rights and peacefully protesting is wrong. BLM was blocking a roadway, and they were using their human bodies and motor vehicles to block other people from going about their business. That is physical force. That's not peaceful protest. If you happen to be on the sidewalk and I physically block you from walking, that is physical force and intimidation. So let's just, abandon this idea that these people were peacefully protesting and the police were wrong in trying to stop them from doing it.
All right. Thank you, Mike, for that. So what would you say, Justin, to Mike's description of that demonstration being non-peaceful?
Yeah, so Mike, you might have missed the part where we talked about civil disobedience and, the whole racial justice movement of the 1960s and 70s and 80s. That's been going on for probably, at least 100 years in America, that has led to even, the few pieces of justice that people of color and black people in this country have. They were obtained through civil disobedience, through marches, through sit-ins, through the bus boycott, through the marches in Montgomery. This is part of American history, that people march on roads. And they weren't, they blocked road for a little bit to get on the road, but then they marched northwards. They weren't trying to harm anybody. There was even a car that drove through that people that day and injured people, and they didn't harm that person. Over and over again, you see that throughout last summer as well, just these marches over and over again that were peaceful. There were early on a couple of incidents that happened that were separate from the rest of the year. But Mike, I see what you're saying, but it's kind of dismissive of American history, in my opinion, and how people eventually get their rights.
Well, Mike, thanks for that call. I appreciate that. If you'd like to weigh in, if you agree with Mike or if you disagree, give us a call, 813-239-9663. You can also email your comments to dj@wmnf.org. You can text us at 813-433-0885. Please sign your name. If you do, text us. It's 10:30 in the morning, and my guest is Justin Garcia. He's a reporter for Creative Loafing Tampa. His cover story this week is called Taking a Stand. Tampa protester marched for Black Lives and now faces up to 5 years in prison. And a lot of us remember last summer, the summer of 2020, and a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests that happened throughout that year. But what I am going to do is take 3 minutes right now to kind of set the scene for people, just to remind people of what the setting was like. We didn't have anyone on the ground at WMNF that day on July 4th, but it seems like that demonstration was similar to other Black Lives Matter protests throughout that summer. So here's a story from August of 2020, where protesters gathered in Tampa to show support for an unarmed Black man who was killed by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin that month. His name was Jacob Blake. WMNF's Daniel Figueroa IV reported then that the demonstrators gathered to protest ongoing police killings of Black people and violence against protesters. So here's Daniel's story. And in 3 minutes, we'll be back to talk more about the case of Jamie Bullock and Black Lives Matter with our guest, Justin Garcia.
Before this year, Dolores Bartle said she'd never been scared to be alive. But as police killings of Black people and protests against police brutality remain prevalent in 2020, she said the fear has grown.
As a Black woman, I have never felt as scared as I do this year, because there's so much stuff going on. There's so many things I have to worry about, my friends getting shot, me possibly being racially profiled.
On Friday, 27-year-old Bartles joined nearly 50 others along Fowler Avenue in Tampa near the intersection of 56th Street, just a half a mile east of the University of South Florida. Protesters gathered to show support for Jacob Blake, an unarmed Black man who was shot in the back 7 times last week by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
It's time to fix, send those good cops to jail. The whole damn system is guilty as hell.
When Black lives are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up like that!
Blake's shooting is the latest in an alarming and growing list of Black people shot by police this year. Members of the Tampa chapter of Students for a Democratic Society said they've been taking to the streets since February, when they demanded justice for Ahmaud Arbery, a Black man killed by a white father and son while jogging through a Georgia neighborhood. Arbery's killing was followed by police killings of Breonna Taylor and Floyd, both unarmed. Members also said they want justice for Josiah Pinner, a 15-year-old boy killed by a speeding Hillsborough County deputy, and Jonas Joseph, a 26-year-old Black man who died after being shot at 125 times by Tampa police in May. In either case, no officer was charged with the crime. Taylor Cook, a 20-year-old USF student, helped organize the protest.
We want to stand in solidarity. We want to create a movement. You know, George Floyd, his murderers were arrested. That was because of the people taking the streets. So we hope that Jacob Blake's brutalizers get indicted and convicted, and we also hope for Jonas Joseph and Josiah Pinner that the cops who murdered them get indicted and convicted.
Protesters wore face coverings as they chanted, pleading for police reform and more community control of police.
This is a common theme amongst killer cops and is within the very foundations of this racist country. Mass incarceration and murdering Black men to leave children without a father, to leave families without an income, and leaving the Black community continuously more oppressed and behind than other groups in this country.
One protester, an American Sign Language interpreter, gave others hand sanitizer and signed along to the chants. Across the country and even home in Tampa, protests have been met with violence from police and counter-protesters. Friday's protest remained peaceful. Cars passed through the intersection, many honking and cheering the protesters on, some rolling their windows down and extending a raised fist. The few who countered simply drove by shouting obscenities and Trump. As protesters chanted and gave speeches calling for money to be diverted from police budgets and redistributed through the community, even State Attorney Andrew Warren was called out.
Andrew Warren, shame on you to say you need
David Jones, a 20-year-old activist, said Warren, a Democrat who ran for the office as a progressive reformer, hasn't done enough to speak against violence committed against protesters by police and needs to display more transparency in Joseph and Pinner's killings.
Calling yourself progressive and actually putting forth the effort and using your office to promote progressive change are two different things.
Until they see change, Jones said he and others will continue to make their voices heard.
The people know that we're standing in solidarity with Jacob Blake and that we can and will be continuing to fight for justice for Jonas Joseph, continuing to fight for justice for Josiah Pinner, continuing to demand justice for Andrew Joseph and the countless other lives lost here in Tampa.
For WMNF, I'm Daniel Figueroa IV.
And then just a reminder, that was a story that we filed a little bit more than a year ago, so like about 14 months ago. I played that just to give you a flavor to remind you of what that summer was like, those summers of protests, and to bring it back to the interview that we're doing right now. Again, this is WMNF Tampa, and my name is Sean Canaan. We're speaking with Justin Garcia. He's a reporter for Creative Loafing Tampa. His cover story this week is called Taking a Stand. Tampa protester marched for Black Lives and now faces up to 5 years in prison. That protester's name is Jamie Bullock. She faces 5 years on that felony charge and two other misdemeanor charges as well. So just to kind of wrap up this before we move on to labor history in Tampa Bay, actually, we do have a caller. So let's maybe take a call. But before I get to the caller, we're going to go to Andrew in Hardy County in just a minute or two. But I want to just mention that, again, Bullock's brother was died in October of 2019, and police were there. There was a theft that had committed, and he had a previous felony. He ran, and then the police said they found him dead with a gun near him. So, you know, that's what we know about that case right now. There's not really much else that's come out about that, but those are the circumstances surrounding her brother's death, or at least some of the circumstances. So before we go too much further, let's take this call from Andrew in Hardy County. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Sean. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
Okay, good. All right, so one, does anybody notice the parallels between the Espionage Act prosecutions and this gag rule that's being attempted, which is just absolutely outrageous by the state's attorney? Because essentially what they're doing is to try to elevate their strategy to the point of saying, exactly as been said in whistleblower cases, you don't have a voice. We're going to bring you into court the same way we brought Bobby Seale into court in Chicago, gagged, chained to your chair, and you're not going to have a voice. And I think it would be really interesting to do some follow-up on this with an attorney and get somebody to come in and actively analyze the state's attorney's motion for its constitutionality and for its intent. And I just think it would really be worthwhile to actually get a look at the actual legal detail of what is they're attempting, because it's not just outrageous. This is an African-American woman who's been traumatized in her community, who's standing up for her rights. And then as for your bozo who called in about the inconvenience of civil disobedience, I hope he's still listening, because, buddy, the inconvenience of civil disobedience is what it's all about. It's what every civil disobedience protest I have been involved in is all about, is to inconvenience your pathetic ass and try to wake you up to the reality that there are things going on in the universe that you can no longer ignore. And the cap on all of that is every one of these actions by the police is a human rights violation. And we need to be looking very strongly at seeing to it that all of these fine young men and women in these uniforms with their badges and their Glocks have the opportunity to make a trip to The Hague at some point in time. We need to get these people in front of the International Criminal Court, and that's going to take mass action by the people of the United States to not just remove their immunity, but actually to bring them into an international forum and have them put in the hands of impartial judges, which are hard to find in the United States today. Thank you, Mr. Trump. And actually let them face justice in an international tribunal. And I mean, it would be at The Hague, although my preference is to do some negotiations with the BRD and open up that nice little courthouse that's still in business that was brand new when the Nazis were tried at Nuremberg. And I think Nuremberg would be a great place for American human rights violators to go on trial. Thanks for listening to me.
All right, Andrew, thanks for calling in, and we're going to move on, but thanks for calling to the show, and I'm going to get Justin's reaction in just a second. Let me also read this email that came in from Jeff. Jeff says, it really sounds like all the footage and other evidence should be collected and presented before a jury. Hopefully, there will be a just result. So, Justin, how would you respond to Jeff's email there about all the evidence be collected and presented before a jury, and then Andrew's comparison there maybe between what's happening to this protester and what happened to Bobby Seale during the Chicago trial?
I don't want to speak too much about a jury trial just because that's not my realm, or I don't really have much say in that, if it should go to jury or not. I can say that from the evidence that I've seen, like I said, I even reached out to TPD trying to get their side or maybe something I'm missing. But from all the evidence I've seen, you know, it kind of lines up with what the emailer is saying. And as far as the gag order or kind of trying to silence people in court, that is, you know, a very relevant part of American history that needs to be talked about when we talk about this situation. It's happened over and over again where people who are dissenting, people who are essentially sticking up for their human rights or sticking up against workplace abuses, for racial justice, whatever else, oftentimes there are measures taken to make an example out of them, to silence them, and that has happened over and over again. I can't get too much into that just because we're talking about this case, but I feel a lot of what Andrew was saying.
Again, our guest is Justin Garcia. He's a reporter for Creative Loafing, and we've been talking about his cover story this week called Taking a Stand. Tampa protester marched for Black Lives and now faces up to 5 years in prison. And in about a week, September 13th, Jamie Bullock will be facing be in a courtroom, and both sides will be presenting pre-trial evidence and see where the judge will see what will be admitted.
Yeah, they'll be discussing specifically on the 13th the motion in limine, which we're talking about, which is seemingly the most controversial aspect of this trial so far. I mean, obviously the whole thing is kind of mired in controversy, but the motion is definitely a big aspect, and that'll be the main thing that's discussed on the 13th.
And Justin has also written about labor history in Tampa Bay, a fascinating article that's on the Creative Loafing website right now. The title is This Labor Day, Let's Revisit the 1931 Clash Between Tampa Cigar Workers and Police. And the subtitle is Workers Who Stood Up Against Evictions and Workplace Abuses Clashed with Police in Ybor City 90 Years Ago. So this is a very interesting story, Justin. First, before we get to the clash or anything like this, just set up the what it might have looked like in the early 30s in Ybor City. Who are the workers? What was it like? What was the atmosphere like in the early days of the Depression there?
Yeah. So first, before I talk about that, I need to give a shout out to Rodney Kite Powell, the local historian who works at the Tampa Bay History Center, and Cole Bellamy, who I spoke to for this story, because they were very helpful in kind of giving me the background, not all of which I could include in this story, because even just talking about this one incident and that parts of the aftermath took, you know, 1,500 words, and we do have word counts and word limits in journalism a lot of times. But essentially, even leading up to 1931, even before the Great Depression hit, there were already workers' strikes at the local factories, walkouts, sit-ins, marches. This had already been going on and building up to this moment for quite a few years. And then as the Depression hit, things obviously got worse. And all this culminating kind of tension where workers had wanted to, you know, protect each other from evictions, much like what's going on now, where they wanted to get better wages so they could, you know, eat well and not be borderline starving while they're working, led up to this moment in 1931 where the effects of the Depression had hurt a lot of people. There were a lot of people that were going unemployed. They had formed a council of the unemployed that had been protecting people from eviction at that time, that year in 1931, and three of the people who were protecting people from being evicted were arrested. So there was just a lot of this like activity occurring up until this day when they decided on November 7th, 1931, which is the anniversary of the founding of the Soviet Union, that they were going to do a march essentially in support of their union, and they were specifically going to march from Ybor at the Labor Temple, which is now the goth club, The Castle.
Wait a second. So this is all set at The Castle, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
So every time you walk by The Castle now, you can look around and just kind of think about this day. But what they were essentially planning on doing was marching from the Labor Temple through the Scrub, which at the time it was called the Scrub. It was the area in between Ybor and downtown, which includes kind of where Tampa Park Apartments now used to be. They all got evicted during the pandemic, and I wrote about that too. They got evicted, and now there's a gas works plan being, you know, developed there, and all the plans seem to kind of look like it's going to be high end. But they were planning on walking through that area and down Central Avenue, where Rodney Kite Powell told me at the time people were living in shacks with, you know, sometimes absentee landlords, and it was a historically black segregated area of Tampa. And they had banners inside the temple that said "Black and White Unite and Fight." They just wanted to band everybody together to join in their movement to protect each other from evictions and to, you know, other abuses that were going on in the workplace at the time. And the city was not happy about that.
You alluded to this earlier. You said that the date they picked, November 7th, was the anniversary of the Soviet Union. So these weren't just, you know, like people we'd think about today about just rank and file union members. These were literally communists that were organizing this march through the black and the white sections of town in order to unite the blacks and whites for laborers against, I guess, against what? Against violations by their landlords and by their employers and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think right there it's kind of important to touch on, like, nowadays these terms, communist, socialist, anarchist, you know, we've gone through, a lot of people think the Red Scare was just during, like, 70s, 80s, early 90s, whatever. But it's been around for a long time, and it was going on in the 1930s as well. The fact of the matter is, and you can look this up, these groups, socialists in general, were responsible for some of the workplace protections we have now. They're responsible for the weekend, for us having the weekend. They're responsible for child labor no longer being allowed in factories in the United States. These types of groups formed unions in the first place. The unions we have today are all very different now, but a lot of these emanated from socialist activity. Libraries were a socialist project. So I just wanted to note that. But yes, they were essentially mainly communists that day who wanted to march through the area between Ybor and downtown. And that was another reason why I think, or why it seems like in the old newspaper clippings that I read, that there was a lot of kind of antagonism towards them.
And that antagonism, as we'll find out shortly, it led to some clashes between the police and these laborers. And a part of that might be because the mayor of Tampa at the time was very anti-communist and was an antagonist, perhaps, against these workers, against these communists. His name?
Robert E. Lee Chancy.
And noted.
Yeah, and to be fair, you know, this is all documented. The workers had asked for a permit to march. They asked the mayor, you know, can we march on this day? And the mayor essentially responded, I could probably pull up the actual quote here, but essentially what he said was that he used the word Negroes over and over again, and he said that they were very content and peaceful and some of the best treated citizens in the city, and that he didn't want the communists disrupting them and their peaceful, happy situation. But as Rodney Kite Powell from the History Center told me, that was just objectively, factually not the case for black people in America in 1931. Yeah. And I think most of us looking back on history know that, you know, now. But at the time he was claiming that.
And it's safe to say probably not at all in an area of Tampa, you know, where there was such poverty, and this was during the Depression, and when the mayor's name was Robert E. Lee Chancy. I mean, that's just like, we already know enough about the history, and now this is just some icing on the top. It's probably not that big of a stretch to say that there was racism involved here.
Yeah, yeah, essentially. And you know, over and over again, that kind of seems to be a common theme, you know, where whenever people are trying to bring people together, regardless of race, to unite against an oppressive power, there's going to be some kind of suppression to that or a reaction to it. And that's, from what I've read, what happened that day. And we can jump into that whenever you...
Yeah, so tell us, so there was, they marched, and then there were clashes. Go into detail about what happened there.
Yeah, so this is where it's kind of mixed, actually. Some reports said that they were about to march, that they were planning on it. But essentially that day, the Labor Temple was packed full of people. They were having a meeting, and I think at this meeting, it seems like they were discussing what to do because they didn't. The mayor had denied their permit. But even before that, the police, and this is according to reports from the Tampa Tribune at the time and the St. Petersburg Times, and then a later report by The Nation, even before that, the police had anticipated a march, so they had gathered a bunch of men with fire hoses and riot guns, and they had also recruited 50 American Legion volunteers to come out to kind of be ready to suppress any kind of march that might occur. And then, this is what is confirmed by all the accounts that I've read, it doesn't seem like the people started marching. It seems like they might have been overflowing out of the Labor Temple onto the street. But the police and the Legionnaires approached the workers first at the temple. So it doesn't seem like a situation where the workers were like, screw the permit, we're just going to be marching in like a half mile down the road. The police intervened because they're like, you don't have a permit. They approached them there at the temple.
And there were shots fired during this melee. There were, and then bricks thrown. What do we know about who was injured, who was arrested?
Yeah, so when they met and confronted the workers at the temple, one of the people came out and said that the governor had maybe overturned the mayor's order that they couldn't march or denied their permit. This, according to historians and a couple of accounts I read, might have been mistaken in this, but nevertheless, he was detained, and from the accounts, he was beaten and bloodied and taken away. And then that seems to be, it's not confirmed for sure, because like I said, the reports are all over the place. Even the numbers of how many people are arrested are all over the place, and I made that clear in my article. But that seems to be part of what ignited the conflict. And from there, a brick was thrown, and from an account that I read, a shot was fired from the second story of the Labor Temple. And one of the reports says that it went through the cop's shoulder. One said that it went through the back and the lung. So those were conflicting. But it's important to note here, too, and I do this in the story as well, that the newspapers at the time, they only got one side of the story, you know, which is, you know, a big no-no in journalism 101, but they were essentially just going with whatever the cops and city officials say. So a lot of these reports, and maybe I'm missing one if you are listening and I'm missing a report where they actually talked to the laborers out there about their experience that day, they're just kind of going on this one-sided narrative, which makes it hard to confirm a lot of what happened that day.
Our guest is Justin Garcia. He is a writer for Creative Loafing. Right now we're talking about his article called This Labor Day, Let's Revisit the 1931 Clash Between Tampa Cigar Workers and Police. Workers who stood up against evictions and workplace abuses clashed with police in Ybor 90 years ago. And 15 to 22 workers were arrested that day. We're not exactly sure of the exact number, but a number of workers. And then there were some injuries. But what were these workers doing? What were people in the early years of the Depression working in Ybor City? What kinds of jobs did they have?
Oh, yeah. So a lot of them were factory jobs. A lot of these workers who organized this particular, planned march were cigar rollers. A lot of them coming from Cuba, Spain. And they had been, you know, living in kind of squalor for a while doing these jobs. All different types of factory jobs throughout Ybor. And actually, after this event, the unions came out, like the bigger unions came out and decried the communists and apologized to the city. But still, 10,000 of these cigar workers and other factory workers ended up walking out in protest to these people being arrested, and also the lectors who read to the cigar rollers and the factories their stands being dismantled and them being kicked out of the factories. Because what the lectors would do is they'd make the cigar rollers' days better by reading anything from romance to, you know, other types of fiction, all the way over to political theory. And they would read socialist and communist texts about, you know, workers' rights and stuff like that. So there's a big reaction to it. And what I didn't get to include in the story that I think is really important to add in here, just because there's so much to fit in this story, but I couldn't do it all in one article. But a lot of people were, a lot of people that were arrested, particularly 15 of them, faced really harsh charges, and they were put on chain gangs. And they were, according to a Nation report and an International Labor Defense report that came out later on, they were put in conditions where they were flogged, beaten, they were driven insane by their conditions, they were put in sweat boxes in the heat. And then there was a Tampa City kind of purge that occurred after that, where they were essentially arresting, flogging, tarring, and they had vigilante groups who some of the people who reported it accused the cops being involved in this, but that this is not confirmable. But they had vigilante groups who were tar and feathering people who they suspected of being communists. And they just went on this huge crusade against anybody they thought might be involved with that kind of movement.
So these people who read to cigar factory workers, a very important part of the history of Ybor City and of Tampa, what became of them kind of after these clashes in 1931?
The lectors? Oh, I actually don't know about too much about what happened after 1931 with them. I know that they were essentially banned from the factories. I think there was pushback because there was a huge strike. But I haven't read anything about them coming back after that, and I'm pretty sure they didn't, but I'm not 100% sure of that.
But this was maybe a pivotal time in their history where from beforehand, before this era, they were very important, and then it became where they weren't as common after that.
Yeah, because essentially what they did is they helped enlighten and keep workers aware of current events, which is kind of the first step to making people kind of take action to make their lives better is being aware of what's going on. So,
and we don't want that. This is WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm Sean Canaan, and my guest is Justin Garcia, a reporter for Creative Loafing Tampa. Right now we're talking about his story called This Labor Day, Let's Revisit the 1931 Clash Between Tampa Cigar Workers and Police. Earlier we talked about a Black Lives Matter demonstrator who was arrested last 4th of July of 2020 and is going to be in court, or at least their defense team is going to be in court this month. Let's tie this all together. What does these clashes that in the early days of the Great Depression and talking to people in poverty and race, how is this all kind of meshed together with, especially today with when we're talking about the moratorium on evictions ending? This can all be kind of brought to the present day. How would you do that?
Yeah. We're 90 years on from that clash in November. On November 7th, there'll be 90 years of time that's passed when that clash occurred in Ybor. And now we're seeing a lot of the same things unfolding that workers were standing up against at that time, right? Like currently there are groups defending people across Tampa Bay from eviction. We're still in the middle of a raging pandemic. Hospitals are still full. People are dying en masse. And yet thousands of people are set up for eviction in Tampa Bay. And I've actually written about that recently too, and the groups that are trying to defend them. So you see these parallels between 1931 and 2021, where once again, people are having to kind of do the same thing that they had to do then, a generation ago, to just have basic human needs met, to have a roof above their heads. And back then, there wasn't even a pandemic. There was a Great Depression, but now we have a pandemic on our hands. This generation alone has gone through two economic collapses and a pandemic. And still, I think it's very interesting that under the system of capitalism, that a lot of people are having to essentially relive the lives that other people had to just to gain basic human rights like housing and food and these things that should be there for people, especially during a pandemic.
So Justin, what's coming next? What are you working on now, and when might we see your next stories?
I'm working on a few different things. I really can't go too deep into what I'm working on. There are a couple of investigations that I'm doing related to these other stories that I've written. And thanks again to everybody who sends me tips, justin@cltampa.com. Can I do that?
Yeah.
But I can't talk too much about that. I will say I will be following the Jamie Bullock trial closely, as I have been. And I will be essentially covering aspects from labor to prisons to police to environment. So I'm out here, and get in contact if you want to talk to me.
Well, Justin, thanks so much for coming on WMNF.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it. Justin Garcia is a reporter for Creative Loafing Tampa. His cover story this week is called Taking a Stand, Tampa Protester Marched for Black Lives and Now Faces Up to 5 Years in Prison. Also on CL Tampa's website, This Labor Day, Let's Revisit the 1931 Clash Between Tampa Cigar Workers and Police. Well, thanks to Barbara Fling for answering our phones. I'm Sean Canaan. Stay tuned next for Janelle Irwin in her new time. That's 11 o'clock on Tuesday mornings. Well, that's coming up after NPR headlines. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening to WMNF.org.